All right. Well, tonight we are going to start taking a look at the book of Esther. I'm going to go over it whenever I'm up here. I'll be this Wednesday, next Wednesday, but then we're gone the following Wednesday. And rather than having somebody else jump in and then have them jump out, I'll just do 2 weeks. So, and then we'll pick it up again once I get up here again. So, Esther. So first of all, let's kind of start off. What can people tell me about the book of Esther? Why is it called Esther? Anyone, shout it out. Named after a queen. Yes, good answer. It's a really good answer. What else can you tell me about the book of Esther? When did it take place? Does anyone know? Really glad we're going over Esther, I think. So, all right, well, I'll dive in there. Please feel free to questions, comments. I don't really care. Whenever. I'm good with that. So, the book of Esther. She was a queen. She didn't start out as a queen. It took quite the journey to become a queen. The date of the book of Esther. There are a lot of dates that are thrown out for the book of Esther. But if you take it for its historical accuracy, it most likely fell between 483 to 473 BC. Now, remember, we're working backwards through time, for 483 was before 473. It was during the reign of King Xerxes. Xerxes was pretty much king of the Persian Empire, which pretty much covered everything. It was a huge kingdom at that time. Other world events going on was that the first group of Jews had made their pilgrimage to Jerusalem to start rebuilding the temple. Anyone remember who that was under? What's that? The other one. What's that? Yes, thank you. Ezra. It was actually Ezra that went back. Nehemiah will be going back shortly, following him. But the first group went back and under Ezra, and they rebuilt the temple. That in itself is quite the feat, as the Babylonians had pretty much totally just razed Jerusalem, leaving it completely desolate and destroyed. And so Esther, the book of Esther is going to take place outside of that, outside of Jerusalem. There will be no contact with Jerusalem while this is going on. This kind of brings to a first great point. Many Jews chose not to return to Jerusalem. It was actually a small contingent that actually made that first trek back to Jerusalem to start to rebuild the temple. So here's a great point. Who was right? The guys that stayed or the guys that left? Those that went back to rebuild the temple or those that stayed in the Persian Empire? What's that?
I would say the people who went back.
The people who went back? Sure. But clearly, though, we did something good with Esther here and she stayed. So I mean, it is kind of that's a hard choice to make sometimes. Realistically, they're both right, you know. It would be easier for those who went to look down on, kind of like, you know, Rain kind of pointed out, say, hey, why aren't you going back? Come on, we got freedom to go back to rebuild the temple. Why don't you go back? It'd be easier to ridicule those for lack of faith. Why didn't you want to go help restore the temple? When you're sitting on this side of events, it's very easy to judge them and figure out, to backseat, judge, make those choices, kind of pick that out. One thing that really comes clear is that God can use you where you're at. Life is not about an A-B choice. If I make A, I'm saved. If B, I'm doomed. At least, you know, with your salvation, that's true. But as far as what you eat for breakfast, no, it's not true. God can use you where you're at. You know, some people, well, I got to get the right perfect job to be used by God. No, not really. God can use any job. It even sometimes comes down to marriages. It's like, well, I'm in the wrong marriage. I can't really use my God. Sure you can. Okay, maybe you can be that great example to your wife or to her family or husband or whatever it may be. You know, God works through what we do, no matter what that choice is. Clearly, those who went to Jerusalem had the faith and desire to restore the temple. God used them to get that process moving. That would one day lead to Jesus cleansing the temple and using it to point to the true temple, which is in heaven. So, you know, whether or not you went back to Jerusalem, it really didn't matter. God's not limited by what we do. God's only limited really by our faith. Just like here, you know. Esther and Mordecai stayed. God used them. Ezra went back. God used him. Okay? God can use us whatever we do. God's not... another great example of this is Paul and Barnabas. You know, they were split over a disagreement about John Mark. Paul said, no, I don't want to take the guy. He's a quitter. Barnabas said, yeah, I want to take him. I see good in him. They split. And you know what happened? They got more work done. Could they have visited as many places if they stayed together? No, they couldn't have. So splitting up, they were able to get more done. Here we see some good things happen as well. In fact, we're going to see through the book of Esther that deliverance of the Jews comes through Esther. If she didn't stay and it went back, who knows what would have happened. So God can use us with what we do. what we do isn't as important as why we're doing it. Are we acting with the faith to move mountains? Authorship. This is a great one. You ever think about who wrote the book of Esther? You know, I don't think Esther did. I'm going to go with that one. No one really knows who wrote the book of Esther. I mean, it really is an enigma. They're not sure who wrote the book. Whoever wrote the book was very familiar with Jewish life, though, under King Xerxes. Okay? It wasn't written by one of those that went back with Ezra. The details in the story will require someone to be closely involved in all of the events that are going to take place in the book of Esther. Or they would have to have the facts passed down to them. But the eyewitnesses' accounts, I mean, it would take someone very, very close to the events. Some people have pointed Mordecai as the author. Most likely it wasn't Mordecai, because Mordecai is held up and esteemed in the book, so he probably would not have written a book like that. And most likely it was someone very close to Esther. Because as we see, as we go through these events, there are going to be some things that are happening between Esther and the king that clearly she would only have been privy to. So, the book of Esther has another very unique quality. And it's pretty much primarily unique, depending on which translation you use. It is the only book of the Bible to never mention the name of God directly. The footnote to that is Song of Solomon in chapter 8, verse 6, may include the word Lord, depending on the translation you use. But other than that, you know, it might not be there. So, but there's no doubt, when you look throughout the book of Esther, you do not see a direct reference to God. But I think that's really important. Because if you were Moses and you were the Israelites, and you know, you saw everything that was going on, you know, a mountain burning with fire, a Red Sea cross, did you really have to doubt whether or not God was there? I mean, you saw it happening. You know, we see that the Israelites still struggle with their faith, but they saw these things happening. Okay? Today, day and age, has anyone had the waters part for them? I don't want the waters to part. Sometimes I just want traffic to part. But no, that stuff doesn't happen. Okay, we live in a day and age where we don't have God's miraculous hand directly intervening in our lives. It doesn't happen. Who here has seen God work in their lives? I have. I'll put my hand up. Definitely. You know? When you look back over a hard period you've gone through, or 6 months, a year, and it's like, whoa, I couldn't have made that if it wasn't for the Lord. Okay? I have no idea how I got through that. That's really how God works. God's presence is everywhere, but he works through the faith of his people. I haven't had tongues of fire in my head, but the gifts of the Spirit have long since phased out. But God clearly is at work through the faith of the church if we have eyes to see. I like just turn to Ephesians chapter 1. Remember verses 5 and then jump to 11. He predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to himself according to the kind intention of his will. jumping into verse 11. Also, he's obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to his purpose, who works all things after the counsel of his will. In both of those verses, it talks about will. Did you ever think God had a will? He does. What is our will? It's what we want to happen. God has a will too, what he wants to see happen. You know, and God's will be done. Okay, you know, we can see it again throughout history. We've seen those try to work against God's will, and you know, a lot of times he ends up using them too. You know, so God's will and purpose will be accomplished at the end of all things. It can't be stopped. And that is the overall picture that Esther brings out. God is faithful to those who are faithful to him. God can take down walls and move mountains. We see in the Old Testament he physically did that. Again, today we don't actually physically see that happening, but sometimes you can see those obstacles taken out of your life. God's working in this in our lives might not be as obvious as the plagues of Egypt, but it happens all the time. But just like Esther, it's going to require faith on our part. One thing that's going to come out of the book of Esther is that there are things happening, but they all happen based upon the will of the individuals who are in it. Esther, Mordecai are the prime examples of that. See, faith requires action. Faith is when we're forced to make a choice. Are we going to rely on God or grab the reins of control? Esther's another great example, because you're going to see people try to grab the reins of control physically, and you're going to see the wheels blow off the bus. You know, if you've read the book, Haman, you know, he ends up, it ends up not working out well for him. And really, God has this happening for a reason. Is faith that is not never tested, is that really a faith? You know, if your faith is already singing hymns and raising your hands to the Lord and all of this, is that really a faith? That's not a faith. That's why, you know, it's offset up from here, and it's coming. I don't know when. But persecution of the church. It's like, man, that stinks. Well, yes and no. We're going to find out if you believe this thing. Esther, you know, she's going to find out if she really believes this thing as she goes through it. Because she's, you know, it's her life and the life of her people are going to be on the line. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Well, how do you know have that assurance? Well, really, you got to go through some testing. That's when our real faith comes out. So let's take a look at the various people in the book of Esther. Let's start with King Xerxes. I have no idea if I'm saying his name right. Xerxes was the king of Persia, and he reigned in Persia from 485 BC to 465 BC. So he reigned for about 20 years. And you have to realize, at this time, Persia was huge. The only thing that was going to take out Persia is going to be Rome, really. That's really good. What's going to ultimately take them out. Xerxes was the son of Darius I, who died from, what I can tell, of old age, failing health at the age of 64. This Darius was the same Darius from the book of Ezra. Again, how these two books kind of tie together. He found the decree of Cyrus that the Jews should be declared to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. Xerxes' mother was the daughter of Cyrus. And that Cyrus is the same Cyrus that actually made the decree that the Jews could go back to Jerusalem. And so Xerxes really is basically married to the granddaughter of Cyrus. See how God kind of works all these things together? It's pretty amazing how God does that throughout history. So you would think, wow, his grandfather was Cyrus. He must be a good guy. No, he's a really bad guy. Okay, the only bright spot in Xerxes' life is going to be the book of Esther. It's funny because my picture of Xerxes always comes from Adventures in Odyssey's version of Esther. And when I hear that, he's this nice guy. No, he's not a nice guy. He's really, really a train wreck. One example, he was basically a very cruel guy. One example, To build the Persian army up for the Greek invasion, the invasion of Greece, King Xerxes enforced a conscription throughout his empire. Among those conscripted were the five sons of Pythias, a Lydian governor. Pythias requested that his eldest son be allowed to remain as his heir. Xerxes was kind of up and down mood. You know, he had major mood swings. Unfortunately, this wasn't a good one. Xerxes believed that Pythias doubted the success of the invasion, so he was worried his son wouldn't come back. So he reportedly had Pythias' son cut in half and displayed the corpse on either side of the road and marched the army right in between the remains. So do you think there were very many more people who didn't want to go? Probably not. Okay, but unfortunately, this was Xerxes. This was how he was wired. He was wired to make an example and wired to... You never told him no. He never liked to be challenged or contradicted in anything he chose to do. And his one great accomplishment he wanted to accomplish, he spent 20 years trying to do this, and history says he kind of sort of did it, was to invade Greece. He took about an 800,000 man army to go and try and take out Greece in about between 480 and 475 BC. Sadly, history will describe Xerxes as a very weak man. You know, again, his mood swings kind of went up and down. He had great power, but he abused that. And he was a tyrant. And like I said, Xerxes inherited was at that time was probably the most powerful nation around. No one could touch Persia at that time. Like I said, in 480 BC, he started going out trying to take out Greece. And the results were so-so. He really didn't take out Greece. He definitely put a dent in them and hurt their country. But they really weren't able to do... they really weren't able to totally overcome it. This probably led to Greece actually in the long run, you know, gaining more and more power, causing the Persian downfall, which ultimately Rome came in and wiped them both out. Like I said, he had an ego, Xerxes did. Persia was a very wealthy nation at the time. Xerxes, he managed to take care of that. He managed to wipe out most of Persia's resources on these huge building programs. A lot of them, basically. What is a great ruler worried about? Is what they remember him for. Well, even ours are, you know. Even our presidents, they want to pass some great legislation that they're remembered for. No one will forget Obamacare, whether good or bad. So, but yeah, because they know they're mortal. Xerxes knew he was a man. He knew he was going to die. So he started building these huge monuments and buildings so they would remember him. He built an enormous audience hall, a palace treasury, and multiple monuments. He had lots of huge growth endeavors, all of which basically depleted Persia of its enormous resources. So we have a picture of a government leader with multiple power and authority spending the people's money. Have you seen that one happen before? I mean, I kid you not, just a note, I got something, you know, our national debt went up by like $370 billion over a week. Where's that going to end? And what are we doing with it? Well, trying to make monuments to Biden, probably. But that's what bad government does. Xerxes was not a good ruler. Like I said, he wasn't a moral man. He had a reputation for cruel punishment, womanizing, and as we saw, you know, basically wiping out the country's resources on personal agendas. The one bright spot of Xerxes' life was the Book of Esther. It really was. His interaction with Esther and him saving the Jews. And this really kind of like I hit about a little bit earlier. This really shows how God uses all of history to accomplish his purpose. We might look around right now and say, how is God going to use America as the train wreck it is? Well, hey, we had 170 people at peaks. We get record turnouts at camps over all the time. So, hey, maybe that's what it's for. Maybe it's to get people to start looking up. God's not restricted nor limited to those that choose to serve him. See, man makes all sorts of plans that he wants. But God's purpose will always be achieved of, in spite of, or even through, those that choose not to yield to God's will. Guess how Xerxes died? Come on, just guess. Just throw it out there. Hit by a bus. I don't care. What's that? Heart attack. No. Assassinated. That's great. Double bonus points if you know who killed him. You nailed it. Double bonus points for Rain. You're right. So when you're assassinated by your son, you've got one or two things. You're either a really bad ruler or a really bad parent. I mean, either way you slice it or dice it, it really goes to show the type of person that Xerxes was. So let's move on to Mordecai. So Mordecai is basically, and this is always kind of weird in my mind, but Mordecai was Esther's cousin. You really want to think when you read the book that he's her uncle, because he was definitely older than her, and he raised her. But that was not the case. Jump over to the book of Esther. Esther chapter 2. We're just going to read verses 5 and 6. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. He had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. So Mordecai, he was older. I mean, he'd survived the exile and was now living there. So he'd been around a little while. He's described as being the son of Jair from the tribe of Benjamin. So he was a Benjaminite. Did you ever look at the Benjamites? So that's another thing, but they were definitely a tough people. And like I said, there was a significant age gap between Esther and Mordecai. Esther's parents were dead, and so he ends up being her guardian. That again shows the character of Mordecai. He takes in an orphan girl. This is his cousin, but he took her in, took care of her. He was a good guy. What's interesting to note historically is that there are actually two sites that are proposed to be the tombs of Esther and Mordecai. Neither can be 100% verified. But the really cool takeaway from this is Esther and Mordecai are historical figures. These aren't people that were made up, that were written stories just to make the Jews happy so they could celebrate Purim or whatever. Okay? These are historical people, and they prove that the Bible is historically accurate. As we read the book of Esther, we'll see that Mordecai, he's a man of deep convictions. Well, you see, he's a man of deep faith. The book of Esther is titled Esther, okay? But it could easily be Mordecai. Because you really have to ask yourself, would Esther be Esther without Mordecai? As we're going through this, I would say no. Would Esther even be alive without Mordecai? I mean, you have a huge opportunity to instill, and I would say if you have kids, you have a huge opportunity to instill faith in your children. But even in the body, we have the opportunity to instill faith in all of the kids here. Through the preaching, the teaching, the encouragement. I'm always super excited. I got the Williams boys up here, and I know all three of them were at peaks. That was fantastic. Hey, what a great opportunity to build your faith. Because one thing Satan just, if he takes the easy way out, he's just going to wait for us all to die. And then he'll just take over the next generation. So Mordecai was a man of faith, and he passed that faith on down to Esther. You know, daily his faith would have been displayed on how he lived his life. Mordecai's faith wasn't something he did. It was really who he was. We'll see that as we go through the book of Esther with his actions and how he lived his life. And it really becomes evident when persecution arises toward the Jews. We're going to see he's like, hey, God's will be done. Again, that is a man of faith. And as I talked about earlier, that's when your faith really shows up. When the trials come and the wheels fall off the bus and there is no steering wheel. It will be through Mordecai's encouragement that Esther ends up being the source of deliverance for the Jews. As I said, the book's Esther, but it could have been Mordecai just as easily. The other great thing that we're going to see in Mordecai compared to his adversary Haman is Mordecai is a man of genuine humility. He never makes demands or assumes to have any influence or power. And he doesn't, even when he does good deeds, sometimes they get overlooked. You know what? He doesn't make a big show about it. Because, you know, it's not said directly, but if you look in there, you're going to see a man who does what he does, not for any sort of power, any sort of recognition, but he does it because it's right in the eyes of the Lord. And that's really the people that God can use. God, he's a great man of humility, and his humility pays off as he ends up getting elevated to being the second in power in the Persian kingdom. Humility is always rewarded by God. Pride is condemned. Jump to Luke chapter 14. We're going to read 7 through 11. And began speaking a parable to the uninvited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, "When you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this man,' and then in disgrace you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you're invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend,' and move up higher, and then you may have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, he who humbles himself will be exalted." As we go through this and look at Mordecai's life, he exemplifies this. He never tries to take the power of position or anything like that. He humbly just does what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And the Lord can use that. If you ever think that, you know, God doesn't see what you're doing, he does. How do you know God sees what you're doing? Faith. The book of Esther is it's a book of faith, it really is. Because there's no direct intervention by God. Okay? You're doing a great job at work, no one seems to notice. You know, those who are sucking up to the boss get more attention. You know what? God sees that. He'll exalt you at the right time. Maybe it won't be at that job, maybe at next job, maybe it'll be you'll have a great family life, maybe you'll make it to heaven. I don't know exactly how it'll play out. Sometimes the side of eternity, we don't even see those things. It's very hard to see those things there. But God will exalt the humble. The humble will inherit the earth. So we're getting down, now let's get down to the heroine of the story, Esther. As I noted earlier, Esther is the cousin of Mordecai. Her original birth name was Hadassah, which for me, when I looked it up, and if you can come up with a better definition, I'm all for it. It means myrtle in Hebrew. I don't quite know. Maybe they said it's the color of myrtle. I'm not really sure. Her name was changed, most likely, to Esther, to hide her Jewish ancestry. Esther, which, from what I could see, literally meant to hide or conceal, which is really what Esther was doing with her Jewish ancestry. Esther was an orphan. Her parents had died sometime earlier. We don't get a specific date, but the indications are that she had been with Mordecai for some time. You can see this because she does what Mordecai asks of her. Okay, kids, do what your parents ask of you. Okay, God might be using you to do something great. She willingly submits to Mordecai. And not only that, she trusts his counsel. And some of his counsel, it's like, whoa, where's this going, uncle? You know, go basically, you know, get in line with the rest of the young ladies to spend a night with the king. I mean, that's a tall order if you think about it. I mean, that's a really tall order. But she did it. She didn't fight back. She trusted in Mordecai. And who did Mordecai trust in? The Lord. And that's really where our faith needs to be. It needs to be in the Lord. But in young people, though, that's why God gives you good parents. Because they can direct you to the Lord. And if they're directing that way, make sure you listen to them. Esther's age really isn't given, but you can make a pretty good guess. You know, I was looking and I saw some says, well, maybe she was older. No, I don't think so. Okay, that's not what Xerxes wanted. He wanted all the young, good-looking ladies in the assembly, or in the Senate, not in the assembly, in the kingdom to basically schedule a night with him. That's what he wanted. He wanted young, he wanted attractive. That's what he was after. The fact that she was beautiful enough to be chosen as a candidate for a queen would indicate so. Xerxes' character dictates that he would only want the prettiest and the youngest virgins as part of his harem. So the most accurate estimation of Esther's age is 14 to 16. So think about that, teenage girls, or even non-teenage girls. Okay? Again, we look back on Esther and it's like, whoa, what a woman of faith. Imagine if you were 14 and 16 and said, okay, you're going to go enter this program, and for about a year, they're going to make you look and smell as good as possible, and then you're going to spend one night with Joe Biden. No, I'm joking. but you're going to spend one night with the king. That is true. And she had zero choice in the matter. That part I'm not joking about. When they corralled and pulled him up, you know, I believe Esther, if she was like every other young teenage girl, had dreams of finding a good-looking young man and raising some Jewish kids and, you know, living out this fairy tale life. Esther's plans got torpedoed. They did. That wasn't going to happen. Xerxes was older than her, probably quite a bit. And she didn't know how this thing was going to play out. She had no idea that ultimately she would become queen. And even as queen, I don't think Xerxes ever changed his ways. He had a harem. Okay. Esther was never going to be able to marry anybody. That was shot. So you say she had all that power, but you know, I think she probably would have traded it for a good marriage to somebody that she wanted to and a happy family. But it shows Esther's faith. And that's really what I want to bring out right there. Esther had a ton of faith to go through this whole thing. Not just when she exposes the plan of Haman, but by her actions before of that. Her life got flipped upside down multiple times as we go throughout the book. Like I said, I doubt her life turned out like her dreams she had as a young girl. But through it all, she displays courage, faith, and humility towards God in all of her actions. All right, our last dude, Haman. Haman, known as Haman the Agite, is the main antagonist in the book. The term Agite, anybody have any idea what that means? Where that comes from? Agag. Do we know where Agag is? Let's jump to 1 Samuel 15. For Samuel 15, 1 through 9. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek in order to destroy all that he has. Do not spare him, but put to death both man, woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, camel, donkey." Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart. Go down from among the Amalekites, so that he do not destroy you with them. For he showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Solomon's people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the ox, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them, but everything they despised and was just utterly destroyed. So Saul here, you know, takes out the Amalekites, but spares Agag. But that's not the end of the story with Agag. In verse 33, but Samuel said to Agag, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Saul hewed Agag, Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. And that was the end of Agag. Saul disobeyed, but Samuel takes care of it in the end, and Agag is killed by the sword. So Haman's lineage, being traced back to King Agag, gives some insight into why he may have been predisposed to have a chip on his shoulder toward the Jews. Okay, his family probably never liked the Jews. And it's going to be such a big deal to Haman, and it's going to infect his mind so much that he's determined to destroy not just Mordecai, but he wants to destroy every Jew out there, that ultimately is going to lead to his own demise. A root of bitterness will eventually fester away its way up, causing all sorts of havoc in our lives if we don't take care of it. Haman's hatred of the Jews will lead to his own death. As we look at Haman and look at his character as we go through this, one thing that will become very clear is Haman is a very proud guy. You know, we can compare and contrast to Mordecai. Mordecai is a picture of humility. We're going to see him do things and not want any recognition, not clamor for it at all. Haman is the exact opposite. This is a picture of opposites in here, and we get to see which one, how each one turns out. Haman wants all the glory. Not surprising, some have traced Haman's name back to the Persian name Hamayon, meaning illustrious. So maybe he took on the name himself. Okay. He's a proud man, ultimately brought down by his own pride. Pride never leads to anything good, at least from God's view of the world. Okay. The proud might have lots of money, they might have power and position, but they don't lead to any long-standing moral value, nor will it lead to eternity with the Lord. Haman was extremely wealthy. When we look through it, he's going to offer to put 10,000 talents of silver in the treasury to the extinction of the Jews. Okay, so he had a lot of money. You know, the Bible says you can't be wealthy. It doesn't say money is bad. What does it say about money? The love of money. That's really where the problem with money lies. Money is just a tool, just like a shovel is a tool. I can dig dirt with a shovel. I can pay somebody to dig dirt with money. Okay, that's all it is. It's a tool to accomplish stuff. But it's funny because when you put money in man's hand, they want more. When you put wealth, people that have $100,000 want $110,000. People that have $1 million need $2 million. We have $1 billion, need $2 billion. I mean, whatever you put in there, people just seem to need more and more and more. That's the danger of money. Money itself, we need it. We got to buy groceries. We got to do various stuff. Money's not bad, but it's when money starts to consume us, that is when bad things happen. That's what happened to Haman. Haman was very worried about his position and what people thought of him, so he was going to use his money to leverage others and to leverage his position, so he could be the second greatest in the kingdom, right behind the king. Haman put his faith in power and position, and you know, casting lots, which was basically came down to foolish superstition. Haman had no faith in anything other than himself, money and ignorant traditions. Is that very different than today? What do most people put their faith in? I mean, really, they put it in the government, or they put it in money, you know, and it doesn't work. I follow the tech world. You know, Steve Jobs died. He had billions of dollars, could not cure pancreatic cancer. Paul Allen, he was co-founder of Microsoft, billions of dollars, could not extend his life. You know, it happens. money, it really doesn't, power, so what? You're going to die. It's going to happen. None of that stuff lasts. Man tries to cling on to what he can, but in the end it slips away because we're all mortal. Haman was married, and he had at least 10 sons. Some accounts say he has more sons, and they split town after he and his other 10 sons were put to death. Haman was married. We're going to see, again to the young guys, choose wisely who you marry. Haman, I don't know how he got her as a wife, but she's not a good woman. Okay, she basically will tell him, go ahead and have some gallows built for Mordecai. And then later on she goes, well, you might have messed up. I think you're the one that's going to be hung there. Okay, she wasn't the deliverer of good news to Haman. She went anywhere the wind blew. So like I say, young men, be careful who you marry. Haman. Is Haman a historical figure? Definitely. References to Haman are found throughout various historical texts, including Josephus. So it would be very hard to say that Haman never existed. Haman is a historical character, just like Mordecai, Esther, and King Xerxes. These are the four main people in the book of Esther. And the really cool thing is all four people definitely existed in history. There's no doubt. And so what does that mean? Well, it means the book of Esther is clearly history as well. Okay, it did happen, all events that are in there. Let's close tonight. Just jump to James chapter 4. And I'm going to read verses 5 through 10. Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit which he has made to dwell in us. But he gives a greater than grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning, your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. The book of Esther is a great example of humility. It's an example of humility working through, or faith and humility working together. You know, it's very tempting when we go through life to want to try to control things, to grab the reins of control, this life's weird. And even if it's not weird from a government perspective, your health can whack you. You know, there's various people. Lorenzo, he probably didn't see his last month coming, did you? I wouldn't have guessed it. Lorenzo's one of the healthiest guys I know. Probably some little bug got in him, and you're down. Whatever it may be, our whole world were brought to a standstill by the coronavirus, no matter what you believe about it. It definitely did mess up our world. Okay? God, man thinks he has a lot of power, but he doesn't. He really, really doesn't. At the end of the day, we're all in the hand of God. You have two choices, whether to go with it and work with it, which is what we see in Esther and Mordecai, or fight it like Haman, or try to rule it over like Xerxes and then get killed by your son. So really, faith is the way to get through all of that. So, any questions, comments? All right, next time I get up here, we'll actually dive into the book. Thanks.